Thanks to the organizers, John Schottlin and Gunter Ullman, for allowing me to speak today. I hope I don't ruin it by speaking today. Today I'd like to talk about some recent work I've been doing. You'll soon guess that it's a bit of an imposter for me to speak, because I'm not going to speak directly about an inverse problem, but a reevaluation of a forward problem, which hopefully will be of service to the inverse problem. And I hope that that will be clear, but if not, sorry. So I will show a recent computation of the Green's function for the radiative transport equation, which if you were here for this morning's lecture, as you saw at various times, to describe light propagation in tissue. Just in case, that's me on the second line, and that's all my information. And the objective, the reason that I'm particularly interested in getting a Green's function and studying it, is I'd like to understand from a very fundamental point of view how light interacts in a random scattering medium, but also in a random scattering medium where there's an object in it. And it can completely mess up your mind to think about what could possibly happen. Suppose you had a metal ball in some kind of scattering medium. Well, the light could reflect off the ball, but then it hits a scatter and comes back, and it can do this a bunch of times. So it's not at all a trivial thing to think about. And of course, this is reflected in the mathematics as well. So let's begin with the radiative transport equation. Light propagation, absorption, scattering, and various other effects can be modeled by the radiative transport equation. Here I'm going to deal exclusively with the time-independent radiative transport equation. So we're talking about CW illumination. And it's, as we saw this morning, I use a slightly different notation. The bold omega is a unit vector on the sphere, which I denote by omega, just to confuse everyone. And the dependent variable is denoted by psi, which is called the radiance or specific intensity. And it depends on this omega as well as a position vector in R3. Sigma sub A is the absorption coefficient. Sigma sub S is the scattering coefficient. And here we see the decay along a given ray path due to absorption, also due to scattering off that path, and then contributions added to that path from scattering from other directions. And the thing that governs that would be the scattering phase function denoted by F. Here, I assume that the dependence between the incident and scattered angle is only due to the dot product between the two vectors. It's kind of a angular invariance. You can rotate it. And I'll also consider the fact when there's an internal source denoted by Q. Well, we heard some of this morning. But if you look at the data for various biological tissues and these parameters, sigma A and sigma S, there's also another one that's often looked at, which is called the asymmetry parameter. I denote it by G, which is the first moment of the phase function with respect to the cosine of the scattering angle. And it's a measure of how forward peaked scattering is in the medium. And for biological tissues, it's usually nearly unity. So if I remember my data correctly, something like a chicken breast that you buy out of the grocery store, it's about 0.98. And the white matter in your brain is about 0.98. So it's consistent with my concept of my brain that it's a lot like chicken that you buy at the store, optically, of course. So in this case, when I see something like this, that G is nearly 1, that rings a bell, because I like to think about asymptotics, that there should be some asymptotic expansion that's valid for the situation when G is approximately equal to 1. And of course there is. All you simply do is you use the fact that F is sharply peaked about omega equal to omega prime. You do a local expansion of the radiance about that angle. You just do an asymptotic series. It's very straightforward. And when you do that to second order, you get something that looks like this, which is called the Fokker-Planck equation. Now here you notice the scattering operator, all the terms with the sigma s are replaced by this thing, where you have a Laplace-Beltrami operator replacing the integral operator. And so in a certain sense, I look at this and I think, well, maybe this is easier than the radiative transport equation. So just to make note of this, the theory that I'll present will be mostly about the radiative transport equation, but it directly applies to the Fokker-Planck equation with absolutely no problems at all. Okay, so down to the goal of the talk, which is to look at the Green's function. Well, the Green's function is the solution to the transport equation, or the Fokker-Planck equation. Now I'll just put a generic L operator for the scattering operator. Due to a source, which is a delta function in angle and a delta function in position. And L, well, it could be this guy, and then it'd be transport, or it could be this guy, and then it'd be Fokker-Planck. Doesn't matter. If one knew the Green's function, then one could use the general representation formula for the solution in some domain D with boundary surface partial D, as long as all these things are okay. And it's simply the superposition of interior sources with this Green's function and the superposition of surface sources with this Green's function. And here you get a little geometric term due to it's basically the divergence theorem coming at you. But because it's a first order differential equation, you don't have a partial derivative in there. Right? So, and you have to sum over all of the radiance at the surface. Now, in general, you only know the incoming radiance due to boundary conditions, so you'd have to solve a surface integral equation, which is just take the limiting value of this as your position is evaluated on the surface, and you get a boundary integral equation for the radiance. Once you solve that, you stick that in here, and now you can evaluate this thing. It's just like potential theory. Now, the way I'm going to construct the Green's function is by looking at plane wave solutions. The reason I like that is because they're simple to think about. A plane wave solution is simply the inverse Fourier transform with respect to a transverse set of coordinates. Now I'm going to assume the propagation's in a z direction, so the transverses are x and y, which I'll denote by the vector rho, and I'll also separate the z component of the omega vector to mu. It's just some inverse Fourier transform with stuff exponentially decays or grows in the z direction. So I stick this in the transport equation, and I get an eigenvalue problem. Okay, so that's great. If I could solve this eigenvalue problem, then I'd be in good shape, but I can't do it analytically, so being a good applied mathematician, I just do it numerically. And all I do is, for instance, for the transport equation, I just use Gauss quadrature for the integral operator that gives me a discrete system of equations, and I just do a matrix eigenvalue problem. For the Fokker-Planck, I use finite differences, and I do the same thing. So up to some discrete truncation error, I can compute the solution of this eigenvalue problem. Once I have the solution to this eigenvalue problem, I have a set of v's and lambdas, which are my plane wave modes. And I have to do this for each spatial wave number. So it's parameterized for each spatial wave number. Okay, so here's that eigenvalue problem again. And there's some certain properties that are important of these plane wave modes. One, which I'll glaze over for today, is that they're complete. There is a proof of this in Kaysen's Zweifel, their linear transport theory book. There's also a very nice symmetry. For each plane wave solution pair, lambda and v, the pair minus lambda and v evaluated minus mu is also a pair. And this is easy to verify. Just stick in minus lambda minus mu and those cancel out. It's the same thing. And L is invariant with respect to this change of variables. So I just proved it. So in light of this symmetry, I'm going to order all the eigenvalues by the real part, and I'm going to index them in the following way. If j is negative, lambda has a negative real part. If j is positive, it has a positive real part. So now I can distinguish between growing and decaying modes for a given direction, and then v's are indexed in a corresponding way. In addition to the symmetry, there's a nice orthogonality that comes about. You just multiply this equation by another v, another set, and you subtract the two, and you get a very simple, straightforward orthogonality property. Okay. And there's this other, if you combine the symmetry with this orthogonality, note that there's a weight here. So it's a weighted inner product over the sphere. And it's a real inner product. There's no conjugate there. That's because it's a first order differential equation. But if you incorporate this symmetry into the orthogonality property, then you get that the inner product with vj and vj is equal to the minus the inner product of vj minus j and minus j. So I'm going to normalize the plane wave modes to be minus the sine of j when I take the inner product of two of these guys. And you'll see why in a second. Okay. So now I have a basis, an orthogonal basis, to look at solutions to the transport equation. This orthogonal basis will be the basis to compute the Green's function. And you'll see that it's very elementary to compute it once I know these things. So I'm going to express the Green's function as an inverse Fourier transform, as a superposition of plane wave modes, essentially. Okay? This transform G satisfies this transformed equation. And it must be bounded for all z not equal to z prime. And at z equals z prime, I just integrate this equation over a small region about z prime, and I get this jump condition. And because I have a complete basis, I'm just going to seek out g hat in terms of this basis. If I substitute that expansion into the equation, a bunch of stuff cancels, and what I'm left with is just this very simple equation. Now you see a mu vj in red. Now I can use the orthogonality principle. So I just use orthogonality, and now I'm just left with this thing. Well, I should be able to solve this kind of differential equation. I think all of us should be able to, right? Well, first I can deduce that g is just some other function of z and z prime, and this other stuff. And so cj is just solving this differential equation. For z not equal to z prime, I simply have an exponentially growing or decaying solution. Almost done. Now I have to impose that the Green's function is bounded for all z not equal to z prime. So that allows me to exclude certain modes, those that grow as you go away from z prime, in whatever direction you're going. So if z is greater than z prime, things have to exponentially decay. So I have to get rid of all positive j, because those have exponentially growing modes. Similarly, for z less than z prime, I'm going the other way. So I have to eliminate all exponentially growing modes in the backwards direction. So I just put those to zero. I don't know what these coefficients are yet. But I have the jump condition. And the jump condition just says that the difference across the jump has to be 1. So if I take this minus this at z equals z prime and set it equal to 1, then aj plus has to be 1. Similarly, 0 minus minus aj minus has to be 1. Very simple. And you just have the Green's function for the radiative transport equation. All I have to do is solve this eigenvalue problem. Once I have the eigenvalues and eigenvectors, or the discrete versions, then I just compute these sums. And it's exactly what you want. It's the product of the eigenfunction, the orthogonal basis. So this is just like a Hilbert-Schmidt decomposition or something. And these exponentially decay with respect to these lambdas. And once I have this thing, I just inverse Fourier transform this result. Okay? And that's all there is to it. Very simple. Okay, so now let's use it and study something kind of fun. I wanted to apply this Green's function and I now look at the idea of what happens if I have some kind of an obstacle in a random medium. So I thought, what's the easiest thing I could possibly do? Well, this is what I came up with. So if you don't think it's easy, now you have an understanding of how convoluted I think about things. So suppose we're in the whole space, and the whole space is a uniform absorbing and scattering medium. Okay. And suppose I have some point source on the plane z equals z naught, and I want to detect the response due to this point source at some distant plane z equals z2. Okay? But in between the source plane and the detector plane is an absorbing plate, a perfect absorbing plate. So imagine a black plate. And this absorbing plate is, if you have any light coming in and strikes this plate, it's going to suck it up perfectly. Okay. Similarly, if it comes from this side, hits it, it's going to suck it up. Okay. So what I'd like to do is use the Green's function to look at this problem, and I'd like to use a solution method that mimics a solution method that every optics student knows from physical optics. And I want to see if all this kind of machinery works, except now it's a random medium. So it's a little different. But you'll see it's just the same. So the first thing I'd like to establish is this idea of a secondary surface source. Is there a Huygens principle for the transport equation? In fact, there is. Let's take a look. Let psi sub d capital of superscript h be the radiance on the detector plane when there's no absorbing plate. Well, since it's a point source at the given direction, it's just the evaluation of the Green's function with the source at that location in this direction. Now, let me look at the radiance with no absorbing plate in there at the intermediate plane z equals z1. And, well, that's just the evaluation of the Green's function at the different location. So now let me use this thing as a secondary surface source, and let's see what it generates on the plane z equals z2. Well, you just stick it into the general representation formula. Q is 0, so you only have the surface integral. And when you stick it in, you just get these two Green's functions. And I left out the details, but if you work it all out using the Green's function that I computed, you get identically the homogeneous solution that you got up here. So now I can put an intermediate plane between the two planes of interest and use that as a surface distribution and propagate that further to the detector plane. And this is just like Huygens' principle. Okay, so now I introduce the concept of secondary sources. Now let me introduce this idea of the Kirchhoff approximation. This is where you see it start to get a little weird. Let P denote the support of the plate on the z equals z1 plane. And let P bar be its complement. Okay, and let me let the radiance subscript P be the radiance on z1 in the presence of the absorbing plate. If I knew that, then I could use that as a secondary source, propagate that again to the detector plate, and I'd have my answer. If I knew it, I'd just shove it into this formula, and that's the answer. The problem is I don't know it. And to know it would require a very complicated surface integral equation that I'd have to solve. So instead of doing something hard, I look back to my physics books, and I think, well, what do they always do in physics? They always do the Kirchhoff approximation, which is you assume that over the support, or over P bar, where the plate isn't there, where there's no obstruction, it's basically just the homogeneous field, the field without the plate on that plane. And then I restrict that solution, I pull out the support of the plate, and now I use that as the secondary source. Okay, so over the support of the plate, I set the radiance to 0, and over the support of the complement, I set it to the homogeneous radiance. Okay, with this approximation, I shove it into the formula, and now I have an explicit formula that I can compute. Another note to put, something to notice, usually in the Kirchhoff approximation for the wave equation, you also have to make assumption about the normal derivative of the field. But again, we're dealing with a first-order differential operator, so we only have to make assumptions on the field itself. Question?
Arnold, you know that there's a formulation of the Kirchhoff diffraction formula that doesn't involve this inconsistent pinning of both the field and its derivatives. It's a solvus condition that is completely consistent.
Okay. Yeah, I'll take that reference, definitely. Okay. But this is just a mimic of whatever you'd see in even Born and Wolf. And I stick it in there, and I get this formula. OK. Well, this is great. Everything's consistent with how I like to think about basic optics. Let me see if I can push it even farther. Let me consider a complementary problem, which I'll call the single slit problem. And instead of having an absorbing plate here, I have a screen with a hole in it. So this is just like the single slit problem that you learned in physics. Okay, so I switch the role of P and P prime, or P bar. Now I study the same problem, but now there's a hole in here instead of a plate. I do the same procedure. I use the Kirchhoff approximation, and I can get the complementary solution as the homogeneous solution over the support P, which is the hole. Okay? Now I do something kooky. I take the sum of those two solutions. If I take the sum of the two solutions, then I integrate over P plus P bar, but that's the whole plane. So if I integrate over the whole plane, I just get the homogeneous solution. Okay. So now there I can identify a symmetry between the solution I was looking for and its complement in terms of the homogeneous solution, and this is Babinet's principle in optics. Okay. And Babinet's principle implies that there's some complementarity between wave fields. And in the transport equation, we see there's a complementarity between the radiances. Okay? Well, you might think, well, big deal. But it allows, with this kind of an idea, it gives you a divide and conquer kind of strategy. Now I can break up a difficult problem into lots of simple problems. And all I have to do is add them up in the end and be consistent with this idea. And engineers have been using this idea for a very long time to make things like slot antennas and things like that. Okay, so let's see if it works. So I'm going to fix my ideas and study just the Fokker-Planck equation. And I'm going to compute the plane wave modes. Just as I said, I'll use a finite difference operation, a finite difference approximation for the Laplace-Beltrami operator. I'm going to work in the situation where the absorption coefficient is about two orders of magnitude less than the scattering coefficient, which is consistent with tissue. And I'm going to set G to be about 0.95. And I'm going to look at the absorbing plate problem where my point source is now. And this is, I picked these numbers for a reason, but not something that's rational and explainable. But it's a zero azimuthal angle and a little off the z-axis. Okay, now I take the absorbing plate, which is 5 scattering mean free paths away from the source, and I detect it on the plane 10 scattering mean free paths away, and my absorbing plate is shaped like this plus sign. And not that this is biologically relevant, but I thought it was cute. Okay, so now I do exactly what I was talking about. I propagate the point source to this plane using the Green's function. I restrict that solution to the support off of the plate, and I use that as a secondary surface source, which then I propagate over here. I look at the solution. I also look at the complementary problem where instead of the plus is now a hole in a black plate. Okay, here are the results. So this is the situation when I have the absorbing plus sign, and you see that light is kind of scooting around it, and it's blurry. Well, it's blurry because there's a random medium. It's completely immersed in the random medium. And you might ask, why is it brighter just to the right of it? Well, it's because it's off-axis. It's pointing off-axis. Here's the situation where I have the plus-shaped hole. Okay, and again, you can kind of see the plus in there, but it's blurry because of the random medium. So if I take the sum of these two things, I get this answer. And if I computed the solution when I didn't have a plate in there at all, I get that solution. If I took the difference, it's like 10 to the minus 16. So that's zero in MATLAB. Okay? So Babinet's principle works as long as I use the Kirchhoff approximation. I believe you can do it rigorously. I just haven't done it yet. Okay. So that's all I had to say. The Green's function, everyone knows, is the fundamental solution from which all other solutions can be computed. And I'm able to compute these things readily just using expansions in plane wave modes. The only hook now is that these plane wave modes have to be calculated numerically. And I use the discrete ordinate method for transport and finite differences for Fokker-Planck. I'm currently exploring other numerical methods that allow me to do it quicker. There's lots of linear algebra in there, which might speed up the calculations. But I don't want to belabor these points. And this, I've been having fun with connecting these ideas of transport to physical optics, like the secondary source idea, which is like Huygens' principle, but I don't call it Huygens' principle because sometimes mathematicians think Huygens' principle is something else. The Kirchhoff approximation and Babinet's principle, these are all common to an optical physicist, so now that I can talk about random media problems using these kinds of terms, there's an immediacy of understanding of these problems now, which I think is quite nice. And I believe that these fundamental connections are leading, may lead to new methods for inverse problems, or in the inverse transport problem in particular. And just studying how obstacles interact with random media and how light interacts with both of those two things. So thanks for the time.
Any questions?
You ever with the Green's function, you did it via the Fourier transform.
Mm-hmm.
How do you integrate the Fourier transform? Is it something that decays fast?
No, it doesn't. But in these problems, for instance, I'm always convolving against stuff, and that helps it. But it's essentially a 2D FFT. Now, it's numerical issues whether it decays fast enough that I'm doing it. So I'm always playing with the spectrum and trying to massage that. So there are lots of numerical issues.
Fourier transform on the sphere.
No, on the plane. On the plane.
Any more questions?
Your assertion there at the end that this is blurred out because of the presence of random media worries me a little bit. If there were no random media,
mm-hmm.
if I were back in physical optics, 101A, and...
Thanks for identifying the semester. Yeah, okay.
And I just did this calculation. I'd get a blurred out thing too because
I've got a diffraction
field and you're not focusing. And so throw me a Fresnel lens or something in there and I'll believe it's due to random media.
Sure. Okay. But if you take the transport equation and remove the absorption and scattering, you just have rays.
Oh, then it's just, okay.
So it's just geometric optics, essentially. So it should, well.
Well, even with
within geometric optics, so you expect.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. It's a good point.
But you wouldn't get a diffraction
effect. You wouldn't get any diffraction effects. It's just not in the transport equation.
You wouldn't get ringing, you wouldn't get diffraction.
Yeah. That's right. But there's also another point that is missing that you should have noticed, maybe. In Babinet's principle for waves, they also say the diffraction patterns are the same for the original and its complementary problem. Because there's no diffraction or a sense of phase in this problem, I don't get that. All I get is that one symmetry. So it's missing in that sense, but then I make it up in Kirchhoff because now I don't have to assume anything about the derivative of the radiance.
By the way, your Kirchhoff approximation is also called the Rayleigh sum of one because you don't have a derivative to put a condition on.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, 1A.
1A. Stroke L, I guess.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.